We're glad you're joining us here at NRCC Online. This is a recording of our community gathering, as we do each week, to think together about the spiritual journey. At the end of the lesson, we open the floor for discussion. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, too. Go to our community's Facebook page, post your thoughts.
In the absence of firsthand encounter with the divine, there is a vacuum created. And the vacuum is a vacuum in experience. Experience doesn't happen. An itch doesn't get scratched, a hunger doesn't get fed, and it is the hunger for the divine encounter that allows us to experience, not believe in, but experience our deep sense of connectedness to the divine, our deep sense of connectedness to one another, and our deep sense of connectedness to everything. That everything is connected to everything. We are more one than two. Oneness is a better description of reality than two-ness. That becomes not just things you hear me saying up here, but it becomes an experiential part of our integrated lives that we feel, we sense, we are aware of our connectedness to everything. And when that experience doesn't happen, it creates a vacuum. And into that vacuum, we put a sustained experience of alienation. Into that vacuum, we have a sustained sense of alienation from the divine, from one another, and from everything. And we try to fill that vacuum, and two of the most common ways we do, we've seen, are pecking orders and acorn chasing. They're so common because they're kind of hardwired right into our heads, instinctive even. So we learned to learn over the years of human development by comparing ourselves to others in our tribe. We survived because we got 20 acorns instead of 10, and we made it through the rough time. But as we saw last week, tools that got wired into us during the survival stage of human development are not as good at helping us navigate higher order needs. We were born into a time, you and I, when for most of us, we have the historical luxury of taking survival for granted. Very few are going to starve to death because we don't have 20 acorns. But those survival stage tools are still wired into our brains because we spent 100,000 years having our brains shaped trying to survive, and only 6,000 years having our brains shaped by the food surpluses that came with the agricultural revolution, and only 200 years having our brains shaped by the excessive surpluses that came with the Industrial Revolution, and only 25 years, maybe 35 years, of having our brains shaped by the hyper-excesses that come with this globalized economy, this information age. And so those are very short times in comparison to how long it took for us to develop, so our brains have not had time to catch up. And our whole society gives us this luxury of chasing higher order needs because our survival needs are met. And our society even gives us the luxury of feeling the pain that comes when our higher order needs are not met. And so when we feel the pain of those higher order needs not being met, it is kind of instinctive to try and alleviate that pain using the same old survival stage strategies. More acorns, better pecking orders. And as we've seen in this lesson, that doesn't work very well. More acorns that are critical in one context can actually exacerbate our pain in another context. Moving up some pecking order, helpful in one context, can actually exacerbate our pain in another context. And then last week, a couple of approaches to the spiritual journey we looked at. One is to take up the ancient practices. We do that a lot. Looking for alertness to the divine center. We just did that this morning during songs and meditations. We work the circle. We take up the communal practices, working on authentic spiritual friendships. We meditate. We practice Lectio Divina. We learn. We serve something bigger than ourselves. We practice this ancient curriculum, and we take up these practices, yes. But we spend a lot of time talking about that. What we saw last week is that there's another stream within our tradition that says, here is another way that you can often kind of stumble accidentally backwards into deepened, broadened divine experience, and that is watchfulness. And in particular, watchfulness for when we fall into the pitfalls that have to do with the virtues. So, for example, catching ourselves, seeing ourselves when we fall into envy, or when we fall into selfishness, or malice, or cowardice. So you will find a lot of our ancient texts are saying, hey, be careful when you fall into this. And here's a list of things that you ought not to do, and here's the things that you ought to do, because it turns out, watchfulness, when we actually catch ourselves falling into that, creates, remember what we said last week, cheeseburger thought, cheeseburger bought. If there's no gap between the stimulus and the response, that gap is where we often find the divine. So when we create a gap that gives us time to pause, step back, take a breath, and take an informed decision, it is often in the gap that we experience a broader, deeper way of approaching the divine. Watchfulness. In the gap, we find the divine. So, a big theme in our tradition is to wave the flag for those times when you're about to fall into the pitfall. A big theme in our tradition is to say, hey, watch out for these things, because when we fell into those things, when that happened to us, when we were in the soul equivalent to stumbling into a ditch on the side of the road, it looked like this. It looked like vice overrunning virtue. It looked like an excessive focus on pecking orders. It looked like excessive chasing of acorns. Paul spent a lot of his letters talking about this kind of be warned, be ready, be watchful, when he talked about the virtues, and in particular, he seemed to have a big theme, I think because it was one of the churches he was writing to, this is one of their issues, the human tendency to cozy up to rich people, or status people, or power people. And why do we do this? Or why do we do the flip side of it, which is to disdain rich people or power people or status people? Why do we have that thing going on? Because some part of us maybe wonders if they are better. And some part of us wonders if maybe if we cozied up to better, some of that better might just get on to us. Or maybe they might have something that we want. Or maybe we could move better up the pecking order if we did this. Or so he spends a lot of time saying, hey, folks, it's a pitfall. Don't fall into it. When you do that, it's going to harm you. When you do that, it's going to slow down your journey and you won't be as healthy. So don't fall into that trap. If you see it happening, something's up. If you see it happen, be alerted, be watchful, be on guard. And a big theme in our tradition is when you do fall in, which you inevitably will, when you do get sucked into vice over virtue, when it happens, not if it happens, when it happens, make sure you do an after-the-fact evaluation. Because if you do that, then you're going to be better prepared the next time, and you're going to be able to see it coming, watchfulness. The gap between stimulus and response, watchfulness. Forewarned is forearmed, watchfulness. So that brings us to today. That's where we've been. Okay, so back to today. And back to the question, how many acorns are enough acorns? And especially, how many acorns are enough acorns when we have, hopefully, over the last few lessons, demonstrated that the answer to that question is not more. More acorns is not the answer to how many acorns is enough acorns. Because when we're exploring the pitfalls of the spiritual journey, when we're practicing watchfulness, it helps if we know what's happening in the culture around us. Because if we know what's happening in the culture around us, we know the pressures that we are all sustaining because we are all swimming in the same soup. So stand outside the culture, study the culture, therefore be forewarned about the kinds of things that trip up folks who live in this culture. But being a student of one's own culture is not easy. A lot of my early graduate school was in cross-cultural studies, and I realized it's very easy to see the blind spot in another culture. It's very difficult to see the blind spot in your own. Those people, they can see our blind spots really well. And so we need to listen to what they are saying about our blind spots. But I had a professor in seminary say this: if you're going to do this job, then you're going to need to be a student of the spiritual tradition. You have to know our texts, you have to know our history, and you have to know our practices. You got to be a student of the spiritual tradition. But you also have to be a student of the culture, because every culture has its own blind spots. And if you're going to be a spiritual leader, you need to know what the culture's blind spots are. But be careful, because you live in the culture too. And consequently, you're going to be sucking up the culture just like everybody else does by breathing the air. And so, it will be inscrutably difficult for you to see your own blind spots when they are culturally imposed blind spots, but that's the gig. If you're going to do this job, that is your job. Yeah, thanks, Professor. I'll just get right on that. So, we saw last week that our culture does have this one big glaring blind spot. That's the one we talked about it. I'm sure we've got more. Trying to meet higher order needs with lower order tools. Trying to meet these higher needs with survival tools. We chase higher order needs like meaning or intimacy or relationships or a sense of personal value, a sense of personal significance, using survival tools. We try and meet these needs with acorn chasing tools. And pretty soon, as a culture, we develop an acorn-chasing ethos. It just becomes the culture of how we do things and how we expect things to be done. And we begin to believe that these tools will satisfy these needs. And we saw, when we do that, we do so with a pretty strong tailwind. There is lots of help for us to move into that way of thinking. Because anytime you live in a consumer culture, there is always someone sending you the message that their product or their belief is going to help you meet these higher order needs. So, being a student of the culture, forewarned. We have to know what's going on. We have to see it when it's happening to us. We have to feel it when we breathe it in. We have to assess it when we live day after day after day. The drumbeat, that's what I called it last week. Now, by the way, last week I might have intimated ever so slightly that marketers are Satan incarnate. I might have said that. Yeah, and if I could have that back, I might have talked about good marketing. And good marketing is good storytelling. And I might have talked about distinguishing that from bad marketing, which is designed to poke people at the pain point where they feel that their higher order needs are not being met, and then try and sell them the hogwash that this acorn that we happen to be selling is going to meet your higher order need. Bad marketing. To be distinguished from good marketing, not all marketers are horrible people. I just want to make sure I didn't say that. I might should have said that. But when enough toxic marketing messages penetrate our defenses, they begin to shape the very ethos of our society as well as the core motivations for how we live our lives, the instincts that we bring to our days. If you get the right grades, then you'll be a good person. If you get the best paying job, then you'll be respected. If you rise through the ranks, you will prove to everyone around that you have what it takes. You buy the right car, you live in the right zip code, you wear the right clothes, then you'll have the right kinds of friends. Then your higher order needs will be met. And it's crazy when you say it out loud like that. But when we live in this soup and we keep reinforcing those ideas one to another, yeah, we end up not having the time to stand back and see how crazy that is. So instead, what we do is we just reinforce it by our non-thinking actions to one another every day. Now, that would be fine if those beliefs were true, but they're not true, and consequently, they motivate us to chase crazy. and we chase crazy like we're lemmings running pell-mell into the sea. And the result is skyrocketing rates of anxiety, skyrocketing rates of depression, neighbors who don't know how to build long-term relationships with each other because we fought over the tree, we fought over the fence, and now we can't work things out, co-workers who can't help one another move forward because we're in a dog-eat-dog competition with one another, and whatever the thing is, we can't have what we want because we're trying to chase it with tools that won't get it for us. The soup poisons us. And today I want to focus especially on how the soup poisons our relationships. I mentioned this book last week or the week before. And in it, the author talks about a study that shows a correlation between our tendency to drink the culture's Kool-Aid, the tendency to believe that more stuff equals more happy, the correlation between that belief system and shorter relationships. In other words, the stronger we believe this narrative, the shorter are our significant relationships. The more we count on acorns to meet higher order needs, the more fragile become the significant relationships in our lives. And that's partly because the notion seeps in, the ethos seeps in, and pretty soon we find ourselves linking the value of people to the degree to which we get something from people. When we are all about the getting premise, we can't help but project that same experience onto people. And it becomes the case that having people in our lives is for the purpose of getting something. We get into relationship because we will get happiness. We get into relationship because we will get sex. We get into relationship because we will get security, or we will get companionship, or we will get support, or we will get validation, or we will get enjoyment, or we will get fun. We get into relationship because we will get something from those people with whom we have relationship. And then come the days that are the tough days that happen in any relationship. The days that aren't happy, the days that aren't sexy, the days that aren't secure or supportive or enjoyable or validating or fun. And as long as we are human beings in relationship with other human beings, those days come always to everyone. And when they do, if we have had, we have drunk the Kool-Aid, then if the acorn chasing narrative is our ethos, then we ask ourselves, what's the point of this relationship? Why should I be in this relationship at all? I'm not getting anything out of it. This is just draining me. It's sucking me dry. There's no benefit here. Why don't I just cut ties? And the relationship ends. Now let me quickly insert a caveat. Be prepared, certain personality types, to hear the caveat. And that is, for those people whose false self strategy is to be loyal long after loyal stopped being helpful. For those people whose false self strategy is to be supportive long after supportive stopped being healthy. If you're working on your self-awareness and you are discovering that your shadow side chases worth or security or value or moral high ground by not exiting healthy relationships, and if you keep those relationships around and you don't draw good boundaries, yeah, I'm talking to some other people right now. I'm not talking to you. So maybe you take one of those little papers that you're doing and doodle. You know, do something, because write notes on your own false self strategy. You know, do something. We're not talking to you right now. Right now, you need to be learning how to set solid boundaries. Okay. For the rest of us, the soup that we swim in seeps in and shapes our unconscious motivations. We begin to approach relationships the same way that we approach everything on a transactional basis. We make a trade, one thing for another. And the thing is, relationships just don't work that way. And that weakens the foundation of our relationships, especially the kinds of relationships that we deeply long to have. So we do stupid things, like choosing friends on the basis of what other people think about them. Because if other people think highly of the people we are friends with, well, then maybe some of that value will bleed over onto us. In the sex ed book, by the way, it's a good book. I think you should read it. It's sitting out in the lobby, by the way. I talked about how toxic it is when our society breaks sexuality down from this massive, life-consuming, birth-to-death reality and segments it down to little tiny parts and says that equals sexuality. And that doesn't equal sexuality. And we teach our kids that sexuality is not a whole life affair. Sure, it includes penises and it includes vaginas, but it also includes diapers and it also includes dishes and it includes mortgages and it includes health care. It includes this comprehensive part of what it means to be human. And I wrote about in the book a study that highlighted how the saturation that our young boys have with porn has put a lot of pressure on especially middle school girls, because they begin to see relationship be in a transactional lens, and that is between what I'm going to give and what I'm going to get. Give the boy what the boy wants, and then I'm going to get what I want. One 16-year-old girl said, I hurry through sex so that we can hold hands and sit on the couch and watch a movie together. One quote from an eighth-grade girl really struck me, and she assessed her first sexual experience, and she says, well, I think it was okay, I guess, because I think he liked my body, which is a transactional arrangement that says, I think he got what he wanted, so I think I can feel good. I'm going to get what I want until somebody with a better body comes along. Lovemaking isn't transactional. We get into it that way. We get into it thinking we're going to get something, but the sex drive very quickly carries us through a journey, a sexual journey of all the stages of this lifelong process that invites us very quickly into the dissolution of ego. Here's what penises and vaginas do. They get us very quickly to the deconstruction of the false self. That's a thing. That's a human thing. And when you segment this thing down and don't teach our children that, they walk away with this transactional notion that I'm going to give something and I'm going to get something. And they're going to miss what our tradition has called the sacrament, the holiness of this lifelong journey that transforms and shapes us. What happens if you walk the whole journey is you begin to love, not because you're going to get something from your lover. You begin to love because we have become lovers. We love because we are love. That's what the full journey does for us. Well, that's just one example of this larger theme. That's what happens when we begin acorn chasing as a view of how life should work. We get reduced to these transactional processes that keep us from our higher order needs. Now, it's easy to fall for this kind of claptrap when our society is as steeped as we are in this big, glaring blind spot that more acorns will meet higher order needs. Our deep needs are deep. Write that part down. Our deep needs are deep, just as deep as our survival needs. We long to be connected to the people who value us, the people that we value in return. We long to be secure with our people, to find out what we're good at. We want to know what we're good at so we can then begin to give what we're good at away to make the world a better place. These are deeper order needs. And the acorn ethos is not very helpful at getting us those needs. It's not very good to chase extra stuff or extra status and try and meet the deepest longings of our hearts. What those things are good at, chasing extra status and extra stuff, is exacerbating a society-wide epidemic of anxiety, a society-wide epidemic of depression. So again, here's our tradition saying, forewarned is forearmed, and it might show up for you, the forewarning, on a Thursday, maybe this Thursday, maybe at work, and you might find yourself at a stopping place where you could quit at 3:30. And now the decision is set before you. Should I stay and do some extra stuff and get a little bit ahead and make my boss happy? Or should I go home and help with the kids? because it is the witching hour, and my spouse has had a bucket full of whiny kids lately, and you can't do both. Which one is instinctive? Which one has longer-term benefits? I don't think anybody can answer that and say that's the right answer. Depending on the context, any one of us will have a different situation. You could come up with different answers all the time. But here's what we should know, that there is an overwhelming pressure to go one way and not go the other way. Nobody is out there patting you on the back when you say, leave at 3:30 and go take care of the kids. Nobody says that. Everybody says, get ahead, go further. So if that's the pressure that we all live in, how are we to make an informed decision? How are we to make a good decision? How are we to make a divine decision? How do we access the deeper longings of our heart that we talked about last week? We have to factor into our awareness that the pressure of our culture is running overwhelmingly toward acorn chasing equals better life. And acorn chasing doesn't always equal better life. And if we go the other way, we would be going cross-grain to our whole society. We will be facing the pressure of going cross-grain to our whole society. One of the things that I said in the book was, yeah, we got time for this. One thing I said in the book was that there was, back when I was in graduate school, there was a boycott of one of the big companies that makes a billion different products, but one of the products they make is baby formula. And so they were out there flogging the idea to these developing nations that you should do baby formula. It's better for your baby, better for your baby. And babies were dying from infant mortality at a rate 6 times higher than they did when they got breast milk. Because when you live in that country, you don't know how to sanitize. You can't read the instructions always how you should sanitize. You are trying to stretch this to get a little bit further. You are inadequately nourishing your child, and babies are dying when they could be having breast milk and living. And so that's crazy. And a bunch of people looked up and said, that's crazy. We are not going to buy products from that company because that's crazy. And here's this whole host of products that you, I mean, this is one of these big multinational corporations. You can hardly get away from their products. They are everywhere and they are always, and it's hard and it's demanding and it's difficult, and you have to go cross-grain to a whole pressure to do this way, do it this way. But crazy, in the face of crazy, is sane. Sanity is standing up against insanity and saying we're not going to do it that way. And just because insanity has been saturated into the way that we do culture doesn't mean that ought to be the way that we live or that ought to be the way that we raise our children, because it is hurting us and it will hurt them. Counterculture is a great idea if culture is crazy. And if you look at it from a relational, transactional basis, culture is crazy. What we think of as normal is not healthy human being living. In that book that I put up a moment ago, the author told a story. He said, one of the proudest moments of my life was when one of my sons came home and said, Dad, some kids at school were making fun of my sneakers. They were not a brand name sneaker. They were not new, shiny new. And the father said, so what'd you say to them? He said, my son explained, I looked at them and I said, why do you care? His father said, I've never been more proud. Why do you care? Why should I succumb to what we called last week, get into the room with the mean boy? Why should I do the things that are going to destroy me in order to match some kind of expectation that you have? Look at that. I'm done. So indwelling Holy Spirit, may we be forewarned and may we be forearmed. May we sidestep the pitfalls and may we fall backward into a deeper experience of the divine. Be that so as we follow Jesus. Amen.
Here's a quick recap of the What Are You Thinking time we did following this lesson. And as we said, we'd love to hear what you're thinking too. Head on over to our community's Facebook page and post your thoughts. You can search Facebook for North Raleigh Community Church Downtown.
So the first person to speak up said, you know, it may have been easier on previous generations because the way culture worked, the way society worked, there was They use the example of normalizing of dinner time together. But the way our work goes, the way our kids go, the idea of a normalized family dinner is much more difficult. And yeah, that's a thing. And I said, you know, we are working on this community of communities, this joining together to find out what are the pressures that shape our lives, our families. And when we do, it would not surprise me at all if we come up with policies at the school board level, the county level, the state level, that kind of intentionally, maybe backwards falling into way, make that pressure even greater. And maybe we could do something to make the space for us to be able to pursue these higher order needs. Another spoke up and said, so where do you start? These are great, big, wonderful goals. I do want to pursue the higher order needs, but what's the first step? And I said, this was in the second lesson, I said, you know, somebody in the first lesson said the same thing. And I said, how I think we get there is we do our version of what happens at 3:30 on a Thursday. And I told the story of my kids. I said, my kids believe that the highlight of my day was when they would come trooping out of the house. I had a little office in the backyard, and they would come down. I would see them leave the house, and they would come out. They'd come down the walkway, and they'd come in the door. And it was so challenging for me because I have such a strong drive for closure, and I would be working on something, and I would want to get that thing done, and I would want to chase them away. But I made it a discipline very early on that as soon as I saw them coming out the back door, heading down my way, I would get ready. And so when they walked in the door, I closed the lid to my laptop, I rotated my chair toward them, and I smiled. And it didn't take long, I said, after just our first child, before that actually did become the highlight of my day. But I said, you have to know how excruciatingly difficult that was for me. It's not, wouldn't be that hard for everybody. A lot of people don't have this inane, insane drive for closure that I have, but it was so difficult for me to look up and do from my work and to engage in what is, in fact, a higher order need. But I said, it did get easier. And not only did it get easier with the kids coming out to my office in the back, but it also became easier in terms of learning how to do this kind of thing in a broader framework. So I said, we learn not only how to handle our kids better, but we learn how to learn. And we have this capacity to develop. And I use the illustration from Jesus' teaching where he said, if you're faithful with a little bit of stuff, you'll end up getting a broader framework, more power, more capacity, more interior ability to do something even greater. So yeah, that was the next one. I gave some more illustrations. We talked about toilet seats and hanging up a shirt and things like that, that are ways that we learn how to pursue our higher order needs. Anyway, so then somebody said, I thought that was important what you said about putting a gap between stimulus and response, and I really want to start focusing on that. So yeah, so there's a recap. Those are the things that came up. I was so appreciative of the folks who brought things up. I think it went really well.
If these recordings help you move forward on your spiritual journey, we hope you'll take an ownership stake in the community and support the health and well-being of the community. You can go to our website, northraleighcommunitychurch.org. The donate button is at the top of the page on your computer's browser, at the bottom on your phone's browser. Thank you.